of the Edison Institute's Center for the Study of the History of Design. And we are now, this is now November 1st, 1985, and we're back in the beautifully appointed offices of Mr. Brooks Stevens, the industrial designer over some 50 years, 51 or 2 years that you've been designing industrial products. And I've just been given the privilege of having a guided tour through the Milwaukee Institute of Arts and Design, which has a 50-year retrospective of your industrial design. Although I understand from Mr. Tom David, the very talented curator of the show and the holder of the first Brooks Stevens Chair for Industrial Design, which was established by the MIAD, and he tells me that he could only do a fraction. He could only exhibit a fraction of your accomplishments in industrial design. That's incredible to me.
I went to 15,000 8x10 photographs in the files that we just, by chance, still happened to have, if you can imagine, going back to 1934. Now, it was very thin in the 34-5 area because we just didn't have as much photography and records and so on. And that they're still there at all was almost unbelievable. That's a long time ago. That's 51 years or 52 years ago. But out of the 15,000, we selected 1,000 photographs. So you're talking about maybe several hundred products over that period, which doesn't seem like much for 50 years, but there were a lot there that we couldn't have the material on. It would have been too much.
You really should establish the Brooks Stevens Archives of Industrial Design.
Well, I hope you were you able to cover it pretty well?
Oh, yes. We took an hour and a half and recorded Mr. David's commentary.
Oh, did you do that?
Yes.
Good.
And he has such an incredible enthusiasm for industrial design, and he is especially pleased that your career and your accomplishments could be laid out so beautifully, if in miniature. Overwhelmed by the whole.
Did you enjoy seeing the renderings? Some of those
very
original.
Much so. This is for me one of the most exciting things that you were able to
even to
find those original renderings.
Remember, those are ones that never came back.
Right.
There are endless that never got back, that are somewhere around the world.
Have you thought about instituting a search for those?
I don't know.
Clients.
Well, we know that some of them are still extant there in drawers and things and all, but. Naturally, when there are five products beyond the one you worked on in 37, why, that doesn't become too, I mean, maybe it's now in some little microfilm or something.
I hope you can find it, because you really should institute a worldwide search for those original renderings. I was impressed, especially, Mr. Stevens, by two things. Not only your incredible, prolific sense of the things you've done over 50 years, probably, I think, without peer. I can't think of another designer that has done so much, so many types of basic, seminal industrial designs over such a long time. And I was especially impressed with, apparently you are a very compassionate man, because you obviously have a great feeling for user comfort and user-friendliness, to use a computer term. You were one of the original, I think, designers that thought in terms of comfort and utility and ease of
satisfying the consumer.
Satisfying the consumer.
First, being able to have it manufactured at all, but hopefully to be a very usable and comfortable and pleasant and visual experience, plus user experience for the ultimate consumer, because if you don't think about the marketplace and your person who's going to buy it, there's no use to keep pumping them out there because they're not going to move.
Yeah.
And engineering departments and so forth may get carried away many times with a given focus on how something should be done and so forth, trying to predict what a cross-section of millions of people is going to like, and this is very difficult for them to do. Now, we're a little bit closer to that by literally working with the outside marketing and the ultimate place where the thing is to be shown or sold or seen or in the ad or on the air or however.
Right.
And that's better than the slide rule area, which is right. A little bit apt to be back where they're worrying about the plant machinery and can this be done at a 16th of a micro something or other and all right. that, mm-hmm. and not thinking about somebody in Uruguay or Paris that might right. want to spend some francs or whatever for that. Mm-hmm. And it's not only, we feel now that there's a world design influence, not totally nationalistic any longer. Mm-hmm. It used to be thought that the Germans would only buy so-and-so and shapes and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. hard, heavy, strong, rugged, whatever you want to call it. Right. But we think this is all due to the airplane and visual TV and all mm-hmm. the rest of it,
right.
satellites,
worldwide communications.
Worldwide communications. We now can appeal to any human being mm-hmm. with the right thing.
Well, you've certainly broken the international barriers in industrial design and user acceptance, consumer acceptance. Well, what were the wellsprings of this remarkable vision and spirit that you've had? You've spoken of your father who, yeah. and your mother. Can you think back and when did you first begin to realize that you had this mission? It turned out to be a mission in life to make design, to make products more aesthetically pleasing, more comfortable to use, safety conscious, and basically would run better and would be an improved model.
I would have to say, David, that there was certainly no magic about it or any particular inside spiritual thing that was called upon immediately in 1934. You've got to realize that I was launched from Cornell University at the depths of the Depression. Mm. And I saw my own father and his firm
yes.
and their manufacturing abilities and sales, marketing, and so forth at that time. Cutler Hammer Company,
right.
Electronic control mm-hmm. Systems, floundering, wondering what to do next. Mm-hmm. So I suppose we both, my father and I, took this new profession, relatively new then, 5 years old maybe,
right.
whatever, and decided to try to bootstrap, Operation Bootstrap as we called it, mm-hmm. pull ourselves up by the bootstraps, the little tab at the back
right.
of the high shoe that
mm-hmm.
used to be,
right.
and try to at least give their sales force, which was their only arm from the main plant and all its engineers and slide rule artists and one thing and another, there weren't any computers then, they just had
yes.
to think about these things,
mm-hmm.
To the man in the field who is struggling by staying in some hotel overnight, hoping he can make a sale the next day in Cincinnati or whatever, mm-hmm. and try to get him something that he could spend another 5 or 6 minutes with the buyer in talking about.
Right.
And after he'd covered function and cost, and you know, in 34 it would be, now how much is this before we go any farther?
Exactly.
Can we afford to even talk to you?
Right.
So price would be first, and then that it worked, and mm-hmm. then he could demonstrate that. But then if he could stay 5 minutes longer with that buyer mm-hmm. and impress him with the fact that the Cutler Hammer version of that same thing that came from another 5 good competitors mm-hmm. Would be the one he should have. And he probably was able then to make that sale. It certainly happened to some degree. So this then became part of that zeal or goal. And naturally, a good part of it was to at least provide myself with full employment
mm-hmm.
to exist. That's a natural inside desire to be successful
mm-hmm.
and in order just to live.
Mm-hmm.
So I would rather pursue that kind of a conquest than to work somewhere for someone else,
mm-hmm.
which I had experimented with during the college in the summer times and
right.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I did packaging for a grocery manufacturer and did help him just through label improvement and glass bottle design. We created the first wide mouth peanut butter jar, if you can imagine. As a child, I had tried to take the knife and scrape it out of this
yeah.
thing with the small neck and so on and get around the sides
right.
and saw that it was not even getting out more than 2/3 of it, and we couldn't buy another one until that was gone and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So we literally invented this jar with the cap on it. I worked
mm-hmm.
with the Anchor Hocking Cap Company or somebody
mm-hmm, right.
on a larger opening. He said, why, of course we could do that. We blow the glass and so forth. And then in the walls of the glass, I had them blow in the glass mold
uh-huh.
from a mock-up I made,
uh-huh.
half rounded peanuts in the glass.
Oh, no.
With the imperfections and all, just at random around there. And then when the peanut butter was in there, they looked the color of, and this became the grip of the jar. So you didn't drop it and have it mess up things. So
have you got that original jar model?
I'm sure. Well, no, that's all gone.
That's
now.
Too bad.
But that was for the Jewett and Sherman Company, a large wholesale producer of condiments and jellies and jams and preserves and mayonnaise. And we created, you know, the olive bottles, the tall cylindrical olive bottle. It's always hard to unscrew the cap. Uh-huh. I put modernistic side panels on the glass jar like the Empire State Building, so that you could then take it and twist the bottle and the cap instead of slipping with one hand and having to hammer it or do something.
But based on, you should have that today. That's
this, this is what caused this particular condiment manufacturer to get increased business by just pointing to his package as being a more functional way to deliver it. And we, if, you know, if you were dealing, selling to IGA and some of the large marketing chains at that time, they could call up and say, Mr. So-and-so, Mr. Sherman, you've had our business for the last 4 or 5 years, but we found someone down the street that's lower priced. Would you please ship our labels over to so-and-so Chicago Avenue, and we're going to go with it? And this way, we, in a sense, got these people to buy this line in the first place. And then once it was in the field, they got used to seeing it, the customers. So he was almost forced to stay there. So in a sense, through the label designs, which we did as a service to him, and the glass designs, which the company who was selling the glass wanted anxiously to do in order to unload carloads of these bottles out in the backyard, we were able to keep that chain of customer and manufacturer intact. So that was before I even opened the office.
We've talked a lot about your industrial products and automobiles and trains, but we haven't really talked too much about your the packaging accomplishments. And I think you've just begun
touching on this. And even today, this is a large part of the business, parts, packaging, and that comes through the beginning of corporate identity and creating the new logo, the new label, new look, a new more legible, you know, labeling in the early 30s was still almost Victorian by nature. It was script things and curved logos and things that weren't very, they intensified on printing gold-edged labels and things that looked elegant and antique, but they weren't marketing tools. In the new marketplace of the past, going through the store, a girl, a housewife, had just driven down there in a new Ford V8 at 35 miles an hour and rushed through the store because she had to be somewhere to pick up the children. There wasn't time to rove through the store and casually look at the shelf of preserves and so forth. She had to go through there and spot that on in a minute on the shelf. And that
product identification.
Exactly.
Instant recognition.
And that still is today.
Well, you were a pioneer in that, and, you've done an awfully lot in that
field.
Yes,
it's been a lot in that. Been very rewarding.
What I'm impressed with is that you almost single-handedly, in concert, of course, with Lowy and Dreyfus and Delgetti's and maybe one or two others, brought the industrial and commercial world out of the 19th century.
That's right.
Brought them into the sunlight and made everything modern.
And remember this tremendous need to do something to make business begin to move again was an absolute necessity. I mean, this wasn't a war or something where you could pump the factories full of materials to be dumped in the ocean or shot down or used up or thrown away or blown up or whatever. Wars did spirit business activity when they had to go into armaments and so forth. But we were in 33, hopefully not ever going to have another one. Now, that couldn't have been promised, but we had our own war, and that was the war of people of being out of work.
Could you, for our modern listeners in 85 and 90 and beyond, could you describe, I think they have really no conception of what a ghastly abyss the
Depression.
Great Depression was. Can you describe the conditions?
Now, I came out of Cornell, and when I left for there, remember that was 1927. Things were quite good, and we went well through 28 and 29. Then we had the terrible stock market situation, and most of the human race doesn't know about the stock market, or what it does, or what it can do. But the top businessmen and financiers are involved in that, And they were shocked, as anybody was, when this thing just plummeted and fell apart, and people, some of the most wealthy individuals, tried to shore it up and tried to even fix it for the rest of the people. I mean, they were gambling their own millions to try to make this thing stop its slide and so forth. Yeah. But there was something much more undercurrent than that. We were into a position where we had to change the entire procedure of manufacturing and people's approach to marketing and buying things and owning things. And this is when installment buying became a way of life. Mm-hmm. In other words, not in England or in some parts of the world. It was for years after that, you had to you paid cash for everything. Mm-hmm. You never intended to get into a system where you were able to put so much down and so much a month and thereby have an appliance or something like that. Mm-hmm. America, in a sense, to keep its manufacturing situation going, in a sense almost established credit buying, where an automobile could be purchased not through having $2,100 in hand in cash and running down and taking delivery at the agency, but putting down $500 and then so much a month thereafter. Now the housewife then could look forward to still having a new refrigerator at that time or a new range, because again we could take, instead of spending all the $2,000 at once, put 100 down here and 500 there and a few more here and so on. And if the payments were kept up, now you're going to immediately think to yourself, well, was this a dangerous thing, and did we get something started that we couldn't live with and all that sort of thing, and have the unscrupulous people buying things that they couldn't afford? Yes, of course that happens. Yes. That's human nature. But we can't design a way of life without having pitfalls in it somewhere about the system. So it finally, we it was bootstrap junction, there's no doubt about it. And we came out of it.
And the manufacturers themselves were in a slough of despond.
Yes.
They felt they would never climb out.
Never get out. There would have to be some government subsidy or some sort of a thing.
State socialism.
And the encroachment of the communist system and all this sort of thing was the only way to handle things. And of course, to see those lines of men with the caps on and the worn overcoat and all in lines at some plant.
The soup kitchens or the plants.
Waiting there, you know, where the sign said no hiring today and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
So it was a terrible thing. I certainly lived through that and saw it and felt it. But that was probably the greatest impetus in the world, was to help work your way and in turn everybody else's out of that.
Did you feel that the New Deal did as much as it's reputed to have done in terms of lifting the American spirit and providing an atmosphere of renewed confidence? Do you think there was, was that there?
It's hard for me to say, as young as I was then, and listening to the fireside chats and all that you're, sure, alluding to.
Yes.
Those were better than having someone sound like a doomsday artist for the thing.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that you could talk your way out of it.
Yes.
It had to become a unified effort of planning and working and executing things and just making people want things. And if you can want something hard enough, you will find a way to buy it. And that is the system that we have here, and trying to make industry hum is the designer's job. And that will never stop.
I have a feeling that out of the darkness and out of the great despondency of the human, of the American people, that the product design that emanated from that period, from your shop and from others, was a part of a general reshaping and a general resurgence of confidence in the products you were just redesigning, and that there was a general renaissance, I think, in the mid-30s of renewed confidence, renewed hope, and while the actual economic aspects of the Depression belied the superficial challenge of recovery, this contributed quite a bit to that recovery. The resurgence of industrial design.
Yes, very much so. I mean, it was a must, and the manufacturers turned. They would almost turn to religion, soothsayers, magic, anything at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it, and then as cases became proof of something happening in the marketplace, then it fed on itself. I mean, to observe and show what you had done for ABC Manufacturing Company as against others that had done nothing, now we were laughingly referred to as corner rounders and hump smoothers and
Oh, yes.
All that sort of thing. But be that as it may, the more conversation about it, the better. It was better to have them talk. Wasn't it Roosevelt who said, I'd rather have them say something about me than nothing, even if it was bad or something like that.
Sounds like he had
some kind of a theory about that, trying to hammer down the the other criticism. But the automotive industry began as the force of producing an image of something new and making you aspire to want a new car. And please now don't get too upset when I tell you this, but as late as 1954, and I say as late because we're talking about 34, now it's 54, that's 20 years later, of course a lot has happened, I created the phrase planned obsolescence.
And that
may
that.
Shock
you. Can you give us the background on that?
Well,
I was surprised by that.
Yes, and of course there have been lots of lampooning of that, and Vance Packard in his book referred to me as the crown prince of obsolescence, and all this sort of thing, because they would indelibly, or invariably, argue and put this title down, which I thought up in Minneapolis the night before a speech before the Minneapolis Advertising Club, where I knew that my audience would pretty much understand what I was alluding to, because they were in the same profession of trying to put better looking advertisements and photographs and models and whatnot in front of the public to make them buy something.
But it was meant to be an in-house phrase, in a sense.
Well, but I used it in the newspapers in speaking with the editor. And he printed it in the Minneapolis Times or whatever. Planned obsolescence, a new form, and I had a complete the slogan. And it was only when you gave the whole statement that it was understandable. The planned obsolescence meant to own something a little newer, a little better, a little sooner than is necessary. Now, you have to analyze that first. This was never supposed to be organized waste or throwing things away or making them so cheap that they wore out before the 30-day guarantee period or whatever it is. That became the criticism of this statement, but it was never meant to be that.
No.
It was that you did not have to be married in a suit and buried in it. You could have three suits somewhere in there and bury things and make people happier by having a change of view or look or appearance or style or whatever. You did not have to wear your shoes till there were holes in the soles and then put blotters in there, which had been done during the Depression and so forth. But to have several pairs of shoes meant that you could change them and not wear them out, and they would all last longer. That the car did not have to be driven 200,000 miles and then abandoned on a side road because and walk home or be taken home. That you could trade it in, and some buyer then in the marketplace of lesser ability to buy could pick that car up as a used car, whereas he'd have to have a bus pass in order to get around, or a streetcar pass, I guess we'd have to say in those days. And in this way, this is what really is happening all the time. And invention itself is, in a sense, planning to obsolete the locomotive or the motor or the gasoline engine or whatever that came before. And of course, every engineer plans to make a newer and better drill press, lawnmower, outboard motor or whatever. So it is not an organized waste theory at all. It's just to keep, I guess the best is our good old American term, keeping up with the Joneses. And there is nothing sinful about that.
No.
Now, you can monitor your own degree of that. You can overdo it and show off and be affluent and try to pretend or actually spend the money faster than you make it and all that sort of thing. Those people will be sorted out, unfortunately, on their own and fall down somewhere. But we don't plan life to be just for those who aren't able to meter it right. I mean, you can't live like that. If somebody, and to point out that one as being the example of what you're saying is absolutely wrong. You have to point out the 100,000 that have benefited by this, including the manufacturer who made it, the retailer who sold it, and the consumer who then owned it and then passed it on to his brother-in-law or somebody. And in that way, he kept his bride happy by bringing home the new Ford sedan with the new radio or whatever at that time. I'm going to be asked tonight on this television broadcast what the automobile industry is going to do. And I mean, it's very difficult for me to say in a few minutes to John McCullough on the television how the car of tomorrow is going to look. In fact, just to bring up a point,
yes,
let me show you this sketch. This I found among, you must have seen it at the exhibit, that car, that
yes,
rendering.
Yes.
Now that's dated 1942, a prediction that I was making in industrial design lectures out on the speaking circuit before women's groups or rotary clubs or whatever. I would show them something like that, a rear engine steel automobile with ribbing along the side to protect the sheet metal and all that stuff, as a much more accurate post-war prophecy for them to save their war bonds to buy and so on, and that this was the blue sky dream and so forth. But now suddenly, in 1985, there is the car, produced by Italian designers and Japanese builders, and it's virtually the same thing. The things that we thought were almost lampooning the industry at the time have now come to pass. So you can predict things that are ultimately going to be what will come. If you, the thing you have to do is be sure to last them out and be there when they happen.
What is that periodical, Mr. Steve?
That's a style auto, or car styling, it used to be called. It's a Japanese quarterly.
Quarterly, yes. Right.
And it's in, all in Japanese and English, but it shows all of the work of the famous Italians and every design studio and beautiful renderings and prototypes and mock-ups. And it's really one of the Bibles. They do a tremendous job.
Yes.
So we can't do any more than say that they have been quite successful in this marketplace up to quite a few thousand cars now, and we can't laugh at it. I mean, it's done very well, and now, of course, their labor rate is half of ours or something like that, and they can get them over here and still sell them in competition with what we have to make in Detroit. We have to find a way around that, and let's hope design and engineering can contribute to that.
Something occurred to me while you were speaking. I'm fascinated by the fact that that some of these visionary designs that you projected and made prototypes of somehow never reached the marketplace, which is sad in some respects. I'm fascinated by the dynamics of decision making, and could you give us sort of a capsule idea of the sort of corporate short-sightedness that you've run up against in your career in terms of marketing and
Let's not say it always had to be that particularly. It was a case of management being nervous about what would be accepted, leaning heavily on the designer to produce. But remember, when we'd show a cross-section of prophetics of what was to be done with this design problem, we always took a procedure that would take us far out, knowing that there was going to have to be arguments back and forth between tooling and costs and the management and the president's wife doesn't like green and all this sort of thing that's going to come up. So you purposely took them up the line a ways in making prophetic renderings and then hoping that when you had to back up, you were at least halfway from the stodgy thing that he was already making and wouldn't make any change at all. And that has worked. I mean, it certainly, and then remember those constant injections of how it could be and so on and so forth were always there and always in their minds or in the files or up on the wall or somewhere around them. And as you saw what we just showed you here, in from 42 to 82 is 40 years plus 3 is 45 years later, that thing that I thought was a complete extreme is now a possibility. So it was worthwhile even dreaming of that or thinking of that. So we do some of that, which is giving you a little in-house
That's fascinating.
Secret here. And I suppose you even the designer has to think that way, because he can't always pinpoint the exact position of consumer acceptance, because remember, the public doesn't know what it wants until it sees it. Remember, you can't just, they cannot tell you what they want.
No.
You have to tickle their fancy, you have to put it before them, you have to continually pump out visionary explorations and so forth so that it's not a shock, and then finally it's absorbed later in some modified form.
Have you used the device of market research over the years for your firm?
Yes, but it was much easier for us to often do our own.
That's what I mean.
Because when you went outside and found a group that were marketing experts or research people and so forth, to convey all of the information to them that they would need when this whole problem was new to them, and just suddenly being foisted upon them to study it, and then have them put models of flat irons at church suppers and ice cream socials and say, which one do you like the best and all. We went through all of that in the 30s and 40s and so forth, and watch the housewives and so on and so forth. You've got to realize, David, that there's a danger to that. First of all, they're not being called upon to spend money. They're being called upon to make a choice of something aesthetic and hopefully functional and cost appreciative and all that sort of thing. But they're not going to have to take the purse out, put the money on the table, and then take it home and prove to the husband that they had the right to buy it. So that kind of a choice then becomes a false one. It's not the real thing. It's when they take out the American dollar bills or the francs marks or whatever and put them down and actually leave them there and take the product away. That then is market research, but that's pretty late. It has already been tooled, money has been spent, and it's already packaged and out there, and the marketing is over with.
But you're pretty sure when you embark on a major design or a major design overhaul that you've got your market, you've got your public pretty much in line.
Because remember, we know what he likes in various other fields by watching competition and so on and so forth. But there's an intuitiveness that finally becomes as strong as seeing how many people picked up the red box or whatever it is. That one can't be, you know, how big a cross section can you study? You know, you can't start with beer labels and test them in one little city in Cincinnati and then decide that that's what Los Angeles will buy. That doesn't always work. So somewhere along the line, it's a matter in which it's thought of in the first place, rendered, and then marketed and put out there. And of course, the attendant publicity, the descriptions, ads, and all the rest are part of it.
In addition to your highly successful and highly visible Miller beer, relabeling and redesign of bottles, did you also do a Blatz?
Schlitz. Yes, we worked on that.
You didn't mention that, I think, yesterday. Can you tell us a bit about that?
This, you see, after the Miller Brewing Company was purchased by Philip Morris, they began to use the agency they'd had before with the Philip Morris cigarette packaging and so forth, which was a California San Francisco firm, which they'd had relations with for 20-some years. And so that lessened our abilities to carry on for them, although we've been working there for 20-some years. But remember, the Miller beer package is, as we designed it, still today. They have made only one little modification of adding some little symbol on top of one of the labels or something in all this change. It was so well received that it's just leave it alone. It's probably good enough. In the beer business, you don't need annual models. It's a beverage of antiquity. It is a thing that's cherished and bought through pride of memory, value, and the heritage behind all that sort of thing. So it's not like a new pencil sharpener or a new radio or TV or a new car. It's a whole different marketplace. And to have kept them on top has been through legibility, the proper image in the first place, and then just perpetuating that. And the beer doesn't change. We don't change the formula. We bring up a new light beer or something, then there's another variation of the theme to go with it.
But you did do a Schlitz redo.
Yes, and then now, unfortunately, they're no longer here. That was
a mark.
Tremendous brewery over the years. But
a great loss to Milwaukee.
Yes, it was, and to the world.
I'm fascinated by the that period in your career where you were asked by, I'm not sure who, to come up with some post-war concepts of what various familiar and popular products, what shapes they might take, and what new products might well evolve in the marketplace.
I did a good deal of that.
World War II, right?
Yes, I did a good deal of that as public relations for our own firm.
Did you?
Actually deciding that when I was called upon to make these talks and things before these groups, I would find some things out by watching their reaction and so on and so forth. So we would actually take the time to create a companion rendering to something we were maybe already involved in, like the outboard motor or motor car or whatever, or the field in which we were already working, mm-hmm. and then test the miniature marketplace
right.
before groups, rotary clubs, and so forth, and watch what the reaction was. And it was well worth it. That was good advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we don't professionally advertise.
Uh-huh.
The industrial designer still has not become one who places ads in the newspapers or in the TV and so forth.
Even why is that? Is
well, we thought that professionally it was not needed.
Uh-huh.
Now maybe we'll have to change that someday.
No, doctors.
Oh, now they stand on yes. TV and tell you to please get sick for me.
Right.
I mean, I can't quite understand that, but I watch them. This is as close to ambulance chasing as I can think
very
of.
Close. Yeah, beyond it, really.
Yeah, right.
Well, the Industrial Design National Society has not yet permitted or not yet sanctioned then.
I don't suppose you would be slapped on the wrist for doing it, but I think it's just an understood thing professionally that it's we send out brochures or have mm-hmm. brochures and so
yeah.
forth, things like that, which are given or handed out or something, or even mailed out, but not to place a blatant ad in the Milwaukee Journal like, can you please come and see us? We will redesign your whatever. I mean, it's too vague a thing.
No, of course, you don't have to do it that badly.
No.
You could have a very sophisticated, very minimal, subliminal kind of, not subliminal, but...
Yeah, but prophetic
and
point toward an industry. But imagine their opinion probably would be, well, that fella seems to be asking us to come and see him. Why isn't he already busy with something? I mean, it's a feeling that you probably should be above that, I think.
I see.
Some of that.
Of course, you are incredibly busy all the time.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the fact that your first love, if it could be called that, was architecture, and that you've...
Well, really, David, that was, in a sense, as you remember, when it came time to go to college, mm-hmm. my father said, you're going to go to Cornell, and
right.
I had to begin to think, where can I find some method of study and so forth that isn't just vague history or
right.
mathematics or
right.
whatever,
mm-hmm.
but in which I can draw.
Right.
Now, if they'd said, if there had been a course in automotive styling, shall we
yes.
say,
yeah.
I might have said, well, that's where I want to go, but that hadn't been invented yet, you see, really, that far
yeah.
refined. So my whole point was to get, as long as I've got to go, you
mm-hmm.
know, if I have to do this, I want to do something I know I can at least contribute to. So I took that path rather than be bored to death with 4 years of history or
right.
6 years of law or medicine or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the right choice, and I'm glad.
But I have a feeling that you enjoyed it as a discipline.
Oh, yes.
And as a learning
well,
process.
And as a procedure for being able to portray something.
Right. Exactly.
Show it and have it admired or bought right. or turned down, one or the other.
It wasn't
that,
a training.
It was an instrument that way.
Because I'm leading up to the fact that looking at this remarkable exhibit in Milwaukee.
And you saw architecture there. We did
do some. I saw architecture, and I saw this really visionary concept of the
satellite tower.
Yes, could you
satellite
give us a history
tower
of that
hotel.
And what
yes.
it was supposed to do and why it never came to fruition?
Well, why it didn't come to fruition here?
Yes.
It's all over the world now.
But I mean, in Milwaukee.
Well, I'd have to say that this was government or city government.
Right.
And as hard as I tried to point out to them that this was the way to go,
mm-hmm.
The Common Council just couldn't understand and said, Mr. Stevens, do you have a $600 million in your bank account to build, or what, $60 million, whatever, $16 million to build this?
Yeah.
And I said, no, of course not, but I'm sure that it can be arranged financing to put this satellite hotel and convention center and sports palace all
right.
in one place instead of having these things individually scattered around and not any one of them doing well.
Now at that time, that was 1959. It was very 58. Much needed in Milwaukee.
Oh,
yes.
Well,
anywhere.
And
specifically.
Now the satellite concept came from using the four towers with the in the 1,000-room hotel,
right.
250 rooms apiece,
right.
and then the center for all the shows and conventions. And the industry was beginning to live from conventions, having industry groups meet everywhere and people flying all over. Right. And I wanted this to be a focal point and a center in Milwaukee, visual. Mm-hmm. We created the skywalks, that hadn't been done.
Right.
Between towers and right. so forth, just to be able to look over our city and to look out to the lake.
Right.
This we thought would be enhancing the life of this poor fellow that was sitting in meetings all day mm-hmm. and never got out on the street. Because
right.
he literally could fly in there, go into this hotel, stay for a week if necessary, mm-hmm. attend meetings, eat, sleep, drink, right. do everything right there and never go out.
Mm-hmm.
And of course this was also good in the bad weather, the snow and so on. He had his whole situation in one fine hotel which had right. every kind of accoutrement in the business mm-hmm. to entertain him. Ethnic restaurants and...
I know she had four ethnic restaurants.
Yeah, and the central
towers.
Dining room.
Mm-hmm.
And now this has been, you have it in Detroit.
Right.
You
a
have
direct
example.
Steal from your,
yes, you
from your design.
All over,
yes.
yes. They're all over the country.
Right.
We,
the even,
we have one at O'Hare.
Do you?
Which was built shortly after this was talked about.
Oh.
So it was prophetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's still better than a square box
oh, gosh,
with all
so
the
much.
Hallways wasted. Now people said, but we can't sleep in a pie-shaped room. I said, well, how do you know you can't? Have you ever been in one?
Right.
Well, how do you put the square bed? Do you put it against the wall or is it in the corner?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, all these would be the criticisms of the Polish assembly people or something like
I
that.
I see, yeah.
Who just couldn't understand.
Rather
it.
Provincial.
Yeah, I mean, now rooms are not all perfectly rectangular.
No.
You see, you came up through the center core, mm-hmm. you had a hallway around that core,
right.
and then the room shooting off it. We didn't have miles of corridors like the Schrader, which
right.
don't just go somewhere in a box, but mm-hmm. aren't paying square feet.
No.
Right.
Now, I take it this design was lifted bodily from your concept
oh, yeah,
and was
yeah.
recreated where else in the world?
Oh, it's all over the...
All over
the area. Well, I mean,
oh.
in the United States, they're out in California. Uh-huh. The idea is like this.
Yes, right.
But it's a logical way to go up instead of
exactly.
Yeah. in square boxes.
Now, you...
Now,
you
remember, it was modular construction as
yes,
well.
Yes, tell us a bit about that.
It was all modular. The rooms were modular. The bathtubs, the furniture, everything about it was modular.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it had a cost
yeah.
benefit there.
You you have it in miniature here in this remarkable complex in Mequon,
yes,
do you
yes.
not? So you brought
we,
the concept
We decided
here.
To use it here just uh-huh. as an inspiration or to satisfy the one that didn't make it or something.
Mm-hmm. I'm amazed that you seem to be a pretty much a homegrown product. You've stayed in your natal,
well,
natal area?
Well, there was a reason for that, because remember, even in 1934, when all the three or four or five other top men were cloistered in New York City, which was supposed to be
right.
the mecca of art and design and
mm-hmm.
so forth, because it was a fashionable area and all that, I was in the Middle West, in the middle of manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
I had to just go
That's
a
right.
few yards to
yes.
get to the plants, and they had to come out here by a train or something to find a client.
It seems that Milwaukee was uniquely situated for
a tremendous manufacturing right here.
A vision like yours, that
yeah.
you have everything, and
right
all
here.
Of your some of your best known industrial designs and concepts have been commissioned or utilized by local concerns who are now worldwide.
Oh yes, but also we went as far as South America and
Did
Germany.
You? Oh yes,
we Willys do Brazil,
right?
And all Germany, Goodbrod, and
That's
England,
right.
France,
mm-hmm.
Italy. Everywhere, so we had a good experience around the world, but the nucleus was right here.
Right here, and you've always stayed here.
Right, yeah.
Been loyal to your home state and your home area.
Yes.
What do you see in the future for industrial design? How do you view what's going to happen in the next, the next 2 decades and the next century, say?
It's hard for me to predict now, because the computer situation has moved into the
right.
picture, and this is one that, for me, it's hard to visualize right away, because
mm-hmm.
I was used to doing everything on the spur of the moment, spontaneously,
right.
and making the rough sketches and so forth. The fact that you can make one on the screen, that never occurred to me, so it's hard for me to understand
mm-hmm.
that now.
Right.
But if you read that article on Kippen,
yes.
did you meet Kippen this morning?
Yes, I did. He's
did you have a chance
remarkable
to talk to
young
him?
Man. Yeah. Remarkable young man.
I'm glad you had a chance
yes.
to talk.
Yeah, I did.
So he's entirely in that school.
He tells me that you're switching over to computerized
yes.
design
right.
in the next few months.
Right.
So. Will you? You'll welcome that, I think, though, will you not? Because you'll find it'll give
yeah.
you a facility.
Yes, if I can find the. But at some point, I have to probably just let him go.
Was it going to be hard?
No, because I'm just at this age. You finally can run out of gas.
At 74, you seem to be still a vital creative person.
Well, but still, it's a little harder to move around.
So beyond computers, what do you see in industrial design in the future?
I'd say that that has to, well, now it's, this is going to be another terrible thing to try to say that that's the end of the line too, because there, something will come of that, but he speaks of it way off here where computers will talk to each other between here and the plant in England or whatever, and all that, but that's, it's a little hard to.
In terms of products, how do you see it? Will we be constantly refining and redesigning and making products more comfortable, more usable?
Yes, because he says that they'll be outmoded before they can be tooled almost. I have to see
that
happen.
Along with that. Yeah.
See that happen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Brooke Stevens, a remarkable visionary, a seminal industrial designer. You're right up there in the top five, I would say, along with Lowy.
Well,
along with Dreyfus.
They're a lot bigger firms now.
And along with the, what I'm talking about,
the
individuals. Yeah, the individuals in the past, I think you've accomplished in many ways much more than they have. You're a real polymath, and
thank you for that.
I think civilization is more comfortable, more compassionate for you having existed.
Well, I appreciate that, and I must say this, that you've been very